I try to concentrate not on the main Cooper or Franklin himself, but you remember the thing that is not done in historical monography or biography very much is to elucidate the premises on which the life work of such a man is predicated. What he assumes to be established, about which he doesn't have to talk, but which he presupposes. And I have, all in this course, tried to show you that historical thinking is not interested in Henry James Sr. or in William James Jr. That is a silly, or at least an unhistorical, an anecdotal, a newspaper, a journalistic approach. We are interested here, in this point, where we can see that the two are polarly related. Now, I don't know what I mean by plurally-aged. What is the whole problem of the head-on idea of American civilization, every generation just looking ahead of itself in this very naive way, and therefore always being surprised, never being able to accomplish anything, because people who just keep running, what makes Samuel run, as you know, is this terrible book by Mr. Watts Schulberg. They don't achieve anything in the world. They may make a pile of money and tomorrow it's all gone. They are the most uninteresting people, yet to you gentlemen, 158 million Americans are due to live this chilly way. Head on! Always forward, forward onward, Christian soldiers, down to hell. This is not Christ. Christ has never lived onward, Christian soldiers. To him, the past and the future had equal rank. And he had to hear the voice in heaven who told him, what of the created world and what of the not yet created world had at every moment prerogative. There's no onward. All the time. This whole rush is unhistorical. That's why I'm marked as unhistorical. So if I have done anything to you, gentlemen, I've tried to open your eyes to the fact, more I cannot do in such a half a year, that there can be people who I think, I flatter myself, have this different point of view, or this different view of point. I have a different sight. They call it a second sight. As a superstition, gentlemen, when a person could see that the future and the past were all together. And therefore that a child and his father must be viewed in unity. Well, it is obvious you do this in evolution all the time. You do not treat an embryo before you haven't seen what becomes of the embryo. The swan is a swan only after he has grown up among the geese, isn't he? Then you can suddenly see that the ugly duckling is a swan. So everybody knows that it takes some years before he knows what it's all about, what the relation of this, for example, this swan to his duckling family is. Now, you have to wait, unfortunately, until Mr. William James Filius has grown up and become 70 and dies in 1910 before you can write the history of Henry James Sr. But people don't want to do this. They say Henry James dies in 1882. Therefore, the literal remains of Henry James Sr. are there, and that's the man, dry bones. Do you think you can write the history of George Washington because he died in 1799? Or when did he die? When did he die? Well, you don't even know.
George Washington?
Me?
I think 1799.
Obviously. Is it?
Yeah.
He can only write the history of George Washington now, and the men who write the history of George Washington 50 years from now, gentlemen, must write a different and a better story of George Washington because he knows better. How do you think the story of Christ, Jesus Christ, would have run in 100 AD? I can tell you how it would run, because we have found in the catacombs in Rome a picture of how people in those days who wrote history pictured the picture. There is a man, Alexamenos, standing before a cross On the cross hangs a man with an eisenhower head of an ass. And it reads, Alexamenos worships his God. And so Jesus as an ass. That is the historical picture of in 100 AD of Jesus Christ. And today we know better, gentlemen. So history is growing on you and me, because the more limbs of this strange body of humanity are developing, the simpler it is to describe the tree. Obviously, if you see a little seedling of a pine tree, you have a much harder time in describing it than if you see the whole pine tree standing there, because you just then have to take, you see, a very far-fetched view, and you see the whole countenance, the profile. And you know every tree has a countenance very much of its leaf, and vice versa. The leaf has the form of the tree. So this you have to see first. I give you one leaf alone, and you never saw a whole tree. You never know that every tree has the same form as the foliage. It takes both the big one and the smaller thing in history to know anything. Which you do not believe. You do not believe it. That's why all these histories that are written now about World War II, they are not histories. They are kind of attempt to organize material, but they all call themselves, in a terrible, unfortunate expression, historians. You know, all these people who run around, don't shoot, but write histories. The non-combatants are attached to all the staffs of the United States Armed Forces. They call themselves historians. It has nothing to do with history. It's recorders, they should be called, as they were in more modest terms. They are not historians, they are recorders, which is good enough to me. Clerks, they were formerly called in the churches. The clerk was a very powerful man, the clerk of the Board of Trustees, powerful man, as he endorsed, you know. The clerk is really the man who does it all, and who holds the whip. But we are so arrogant, we call these people historians. So you don't know anymore what history is, gentlemen. History is not known unless you know it by its fruits. Therefore, that isn't history which you reduce to some origins, as everybody does in this country, to causes before. George Washington is not at all interested because he had no water closet in 1750. That didn't cause him to become President of the United States. He didn't say, I have no WC, no running water, no plumbing. We must have a country where plumbing is the best. And so we got the United States. That would be causation. That would be what you call history. Obviously, you only understand what George Washington did, that he created a nation, after there is an American nation. Otherwise, you can never write anything important or pertinent into his biography. Why we should remember him? This you have to wait for. Will you take this down and by their fruits ye shall know them? That's a very complete reversal of everything you think is scientific. History is not known by its beginnings. It is only known by its end. In the beginning, Christianity could very well be mistaken for 50 other religions. There was Mithras, and there was Bacchus, and there was Isis, and there was Serapis, and there were any number of your religions, and it looked just like one of them. But it wasn't. Because it reduced all these religions to ashes, because the Christians do not believe in such fancy gods, but they believe in the simple life of a child in the cradle. And that's all. Which means that they believe that God created men, and there are no gods in between. But that had to be found out and understood. It took 1,000 years before this was beaten down, that there was no other God but the father of men, the child in the cradle. It took 1,000 years then before you get a history of the church. It is impossible to write the history of the church in 100. Now the same is true of Father Henry James. Henry James is meaningless unless we understand that he forced, you remember, forced his son to write in 1910, 30 years after his father's death, the moral equivalent of war, and that he forced him to write the varieties of religious experience, and that all the time here his father in the grave was waiting for this little boy, very nervous Harvard professor, to come round and to join up with his father's problem. And everything is done in this, you see, all history today is in this country dried down to dire bones because it means just single biographies. Everybody writes snip-snack-quick history of one man. Gentlemen, history begins only when one man's life leaves an imprint on another man's life. And so, gentlemen, the smallest unit for history are two generations. That's another law which is important. Because by their fruits you shall know them. The consequence is that history only begins when you deal with more than one generation. Biography is not history. It is today, unfortunately, I love biographies, I've written myself biographies, gentlemen, but as it is done in this country today, it's a destruction of history. You cannot write the history of Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson by themselves. You can write now, for the first time, the history of Woodrow Wilson because Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Truman have governed after him. Now it makes sense to say what he really did, that he prophesied the Second World War. But as long as the Second World War hasn't happened and nobody has followed suit, what is the meaning of saying that he died a disappointed man in 1923? The main thing we still do not know, did it make sense that he died a disillusioned man, you see? Obviously it made very much sense. Because he was the only man who knew the truth when he died in 1923, Wilson predicting World War II. Now that's the only interesting thing about it today. Now you have to wait. Before you cannot know, you have to wait till another generation is put under the judgment, you see, of his own light and his own promise and his own prediction and his own insight. Well, this is the minimum. But you see, you gain a tremendous perspective if you know this, gentlemen. History is the time-binding power of men. We do take this down again. That's number three. History is the power to bind times that, by their very nature, would fall apart. History is always, as Nietzsche has called it, Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, has written a very wonderful inauguration speech for his chair of history, where he said about the use and the abuse of history for human living. And in this speech he says that history always must be an article of faith. History will always be an article of faith. And there's no way out. And you hate this because you think if history isn't science, then it isn't anything. Gentlemen, there's a history of science which isn't science. If you write today the history of science from Newton to Einstein, that isn't science, that's history. What's history, what's scientific about the history of physics? Of the great physicists, you see. It is your belief that it forms a unity. You cannot prove it. You can say Newton belongs to the Middle Ages and Einstein doesn't. So you can begin the history of physics with Einstein. That's your pleasure. You have to prove it. Your faith is then a different faith from the one of the middle physicists. And again, I write a history of physics from antiquity to today, and I have another religion again, compared to the people who think that modern physics begins with Newton. With a man who has concluded that the apple couldn't fall without good reason from the apple tree. Where you connect, gentlemen, your faith, there's religion, your religion. Today you have this great problem in the United States with all the agnostics and the Jews counting one way and most of the humanists and not understanding that the coming of Christ makes any difference. I can, out of 100 books written today on history, there are perhaps two that really believe that there is Christ is coming was a turning point in history. All the others try to obliterate it, if nothing has changed. I got a paper today from a young lady in Harvard, Radcliffe, who wrote on tragedy and quite naively says that the Greek tragedy and Hamlet and Faust, that's all one story, all one, the history of tragedy. And so she writes a paper on the nature of tragedy. So I wrote back, I'm amazed, my young lady, that you are already so much through with the Christian era. I always thought that we had no gods. We had no Quaternus,
We had no Deus Ex Machina coming and solving the great tragedy, and we had no hero who was worshipped in the Dionysians and Athens. We had Hamlet, which is something very different. We have a Christian tragedy in the Christian era, and we have Greek tragedy, and they are as different as somebody and his mirror image. That's exactly how they confront Renaissance physics. Einstein and Newton are not the same as Greek physics, but they are Renaissance, and therefore quite different. But you see, you look at me and say, you're quite a surprise. Why shouldn't you write on the nature of tragedy? Well, my answer is, 1,000 years, there was no tragedy, because the Greek, the Eucharist, and the mass, spectacle of the mass, had replaced tragedy. And when Shakespeare was allowed to write tragedy again, it was within a world in which Hamlet was not a god, and had to be deified, but was just one mortal. So one function of tragedy has remained inside the divine service in church, and only the secular aspect of this old Greek tragedy has migrated on the stage and on Broadway, which is very different indeed. If you read Mourning Becomes Electra from O'Neill, then you know that has nothing to do with the Greek tragedy. Not the slightest. It's the opposite. But you see, you live in this college atmosphere, and you are therefore, I think, the gravediggers of Western civilization. Because the common men still live in the Christian era. They're good people. But your brain is absolutely corrupt. And you actually believe that you live simply sometime, somewhere, would make no difference whether it's 500 BC or 1080. To you, it makes absolutely no difference. Well, I'm up in arms with this lady. I told her, this is true, if there's a nature of tragedy, without any break in history, you see, changing all tragedy totally and putting it in a light of a universal faith and universal government of the world, then of course concentration camps and gas chambers were the only result. Because why shouldn't we then live as the people 500 BC did? Or 900 BC. And since this lady is Jewish, she's very deeply interested in this problem. The nature, gentlemen, of all these things which you hear, nature of drama, nature of lyrics, nature of music, means that we have no history. So nothing has changed, and certainly not through the Christian era. Therefore, I'm talking to you about Henry James Sr. and William James Jr. all this time, gentlemen. But I'm really talking about the BC and AD. I have tried to re-invoke in you the fact that Henry James Sr. is the only man whose existence separates William James from antiquity, from paganism. And in the same sense, Jonathan Edwards and the Martha brothers are the only people who separate you as the heirs of Benjamin Franklin from the concentration camps of Nineveh and Assur. From the famous struggle for survival of Mr. Darwin. You all know that we are not in a struggle for survival or survival of the fittest. You very well know that the first gesture you make is generously to help the weak. Everybody does, you see, on this country. Yet we proclaim, because we go back into antiquity more and more, that only Darwin is right. Well, you would be lost, gentlemen. A college boy is so much weaker than a 15-year-old boy who doesn't go to a college, in all his nervous reaction, all his sensibilities, that if the educated classes in a country would be judged by Darwinian standards, they would all have to be wiped out. Because what does it mean to be educated? To be more sensitive. To be more weak. To be more impressionable. That means education. We keep you artificially more plastic. That is, you are still a baby. Now, a baby is more imperiled by its inherent softness than a man in chain armor, obviously, or a tank. So education means to deny somebody the right to be hard-boiled. That's what education is, to prevent you from being hard-boiled. Now, hard-boiled is protection. And that is Darwinianism. So, Darwin is the natural. Education is an artificial, historic. That's done on the faith of parents to their children, into their children, and on the basis of faith of the children in their parents. It is always based on this two-generation principle, that the next generation doesn't have to live in the same way as the previous generation. And that's what I've tried to show you in America as a permanent question mark, you see. But the American people, as people, have always known this. They have always been good Christians, sectarians, Baptists, Southern Baptists, Southwestern Baptists, Southeastern Baptists, but some sect which kept the flame burning of a good relation between parents and children whom they wanted to grow, whom they wanted to be bigger than themselves. But you live in this incredible idolatry of your own mind, of your own brain. And I think, therefore, there's a good reason that the colleges are going downhill in this country. Who is going to let everybody waste his life 4 years in the college when the result is that you don't believe in the Christian era, even? That you believe in the nature of tragedy. Well, the nature of tragedy will come out and visit you. We will then find that tragedy is natural for you. Why shouldn't you then live a tragic life? It's natural. It's not redeemed. It's not. There's no change. Everything is great tragedy, with the curse of the parents on the children in the third and fourth generation. This is what you live in. This is the whole big issue, of course. There's no Christian era here in this college. But there is in reality, gentlemen, and that's why there is a college. But the college just abuses its existence today. And it does it since William James. And that's why I've tried to tell you that this is all right as long as a college boy can learn by being exposed to this nonsense which you learn here. And this unhistorical situation, that you have to re-enter history, which you do by the draft, for example, and by Mr. McCarthy, and by many other such things. Because humanity just cannot go on without you. It needs you in the next generation. Please.
So, you've talked, in the general perspective of the course, now you've been talking about an era of Christianity. And you've never talked about the era of Christianity. You've always talked about the secularism, which is opposed to the era of Christianity. At what time in history could you tell us what all these things essentially understood in the sense that you say you understand them now that we don't? At what time did everybody take these things and
in the era of 1865,
when the Civil War, everywhere in Europe.
You see, in 1870, it was the famous sentence was that God is dead, which meant that the times of men had no connections. I mean, what does it mean, God is dead? God creates and governs the universe. You see, God is dead, he doesn't govern the universe, and he has created it. Therefore, every dust, grain of dust on this every speck of a human being, of an animal on this country, has only his own lifetime to fulfill. There is nothing overreaching his beginning and his end. He lived from birth to death. Now, sir, my dear man, no, one moment, let me finish my sentence. You see, the belief that God governs the world finds expression in this. Here you are born. When were you born?
1933.
1933.
Three.
See?
Three.
1933, sir. So maybe 14. Now, here you live in the year 1953, don't you? And here yourself might be born in 1973. Now.
Oh, wait a minute. Actually, 43.
1973, and he will be in college in 1993.
Two? That's wrong.
Now, the naturalist says that what is important in your existence is that you were born in 1933 and that you die in 1900, beg your pardon, the expectation longer.
That you die 7 times and 9 years 80. That's arbitrary, but make it X. You die 7 times. So your lifeline goes from your birth, here, born, die. Here. This is your, the naturalistic view of your existence. I don't care when you were born, sir. There have been thousands of years in which people never remember the birthday of a person. That's perfect. In any tribe, the day on which you were born was your initiation. In 1900, you came to college when?
1951.
That's the day of your birth in history. And it is. So let us assume that this is the day on which you wake up, and it will be in 1963 that you will make some decision, and then it would be that history would only be important as reaching to some time in 2003 when your son makes the corresponding decision, and because you went to Dartmouth, says he goes to Amherst. That is, when he opposes or fulfills or completes by his understanding of what his father generation has done, the meaning of what you have done by limiting it or by adding it, by undermining it. Now, there are two views of, you see, of the world. One is the natural one, which makes the events which happen between people coincide with their physical existence. And the other, which means that the words spoken by them and the decisions made by them are bridging the gap of the times between the generations.
So what I'm trying to say, sir, is that the era which you speak of, I don't know it has ever existed. You haven't talked about it positively enough so that I can understand the Christian era as a reality, to say it's a time in history. For instance, what was it that
you I mean, you don't read the catalog, and you, of course, you do what you please, but I do also as I please. I give a whole course, 58, on the basis of 57, in which I try to show you what the eras are all about. So I can't do this today. And I can't do it tomorrow, but I am devoted to it from February to May. It's really ridiculous. Don't you read the catalog that this is all only the preamble for exactly your question? Certainly. But you don't read, you just take a number, 57.
Well, you should hope so. If you ever read it over again recently, sir, or matter of fact, don't read your own descriptions, read some of the others. I can only go on the experience I've had. They've never yet coincided. I didn't expect it would work out.
Well, gentlemen, since the lean contains the tree, I have taken the liberty of trying to give you the problem of the history of the human spirit as opposed to the history of the human body, or human bodies of the mortals in us, in the example first of the Jameses and then of the second generation, you remember the Marthas and the second halfway covenant, the same problem. And we have seen it time and again that in the relation of the religious and the secular, there is this clash of history without, that is just natural, and real history, which is created by every generation which joins the march of time. So to get into the hinge between two times, two generations, is the problem of the historian. That's the eye of the historian. That's why there is no historian in this country. And the best historian whom we have, Mr. Samuel Morris, I told you, now writes the history of the war in the Pacific for the Navy, and that of course has nothing to do with the real historical problem. How one generation, you see, adds or detracts meaning from the previous generation. You take a boom bust region, you take prospecting out in Montana. Well, in the 90s, as you may know, railroads were built for this to the silver mines there. There was a tremendous ado, and then the same country just fell flat. Nobody's there anymore. Now, we only can know that this was a rush. because we see, you see, the birth. In the year 95, of course, it seemed that this was the future of America, you see. It would be now. And, but it isn't. We have to know this now, that the people there were deserted, that is, that no second generation followed them. Now they are the Texans. And so what's the future then? I mean, they bought Montana, you see. They have a second dust bowl. And so each time you can condemn or naturalize a history when you do not follow it up. By you are not going west, you say the frontier is finished. But it is, some people have just not to go there anymore. Now all these people from California are coming back to New Hampshire and Vermont. I don't know why, but it seems that they need a worse climate than they have in California. I wished only the whole problem of this question is not the content. We hear about these people sufficiently finding their environment. I'm not going to reveal any more obscenities about them than finding illegitimate children. That's not my business in this course. The interesting thing about Benjamin Franklin is that in him there comes to the fore your own mentality. And this whole mentality is stultified, fruitful living. Because Benjamin Franklin does not say by their fruits you shall know them, but by their causes. You see. And therefore, it is all everybody only to himself. Because the man who doesn't plant a tree for his grandchildren, you see, cannot be convinced that he should. You can never prove to a man that it's worth planting a tree for your grandchildren. There's a famous story of the general Marshal Lyautey. Did I tell you the story in class? Lyautey was the French marshal who subdued Morocco and was a very great man. You can see this from the sentence which he spoke when the war in World War in Europe broke out. On August 1st, 1914, they told the marshal there was a war in Europe now. And he said very slowly, a war between Europeans only can be a civil war. Now, if they had heeded this word, you see, the Europeans, they wouldn't have been going to war. It'd be only because they treated this war as a war outside their, you see, their own natural bonds, could they afford this? Ever since now, Europe is just a den of lions and tigers. It never has become anything else after that. You see, no longer a family of nations. And therefore the sentence is, sums it all up in one sentence. That's a civil war. And that's the most cruel of all wars, you see. And it takes the longest to redress, as you know, from the south. That's why there is no peace in war in Europe. But the second thing I wanted to tell you is that gives you also some picture of the man's scope. He was a very old man, and he was living in southern France visiting there. And he was taken to a wonderful garden. There was a tree which he liked very much, and he had his gardener with him, and he said, "Gardener, I must have this tree." Well, he said, "Monsieur le Maréchal, that's all right, but the tree takes 100 years before it really looks like something. Qu'on le plante aujourd'hui. Be it be planted today," he said of this tree. This man lived in history, you see. Does it matter that I'm dying, that I'm an old man? But don't lose any moment. You see, if it takes 100 years, it's great high time that we planted. You can't find an American who would
would even understand, you didn't even understand the elegancy of the phrase, quand la plante aujourd'hui. That this be, let this be planted today, because now I still can follow in the sequence of generations and do my share, you see. Well, God, what does it matter whether I see this or not? That has this to do with history. You must pray that President Eisenhower does nothing for his re-election, but does everything only so that 100 years from now there may be the United States of America. Woe to you if he only does anything for his immediate aggrandizement or for your vanity or for public opinion or for these radio commentators and all these shakars and jackasses and wolves who try to turn you from the way of a decent policy just because today they don't understand. You are surrounded by wild animals who make it nearly impossible for anybody to govern in this country because he cannot say, I'm doing this so that there are the United States in 2030. He has to say that he does it so that there's prosperity today. How do you know that prosperity for today is a good thing for America? It's never debated. I think it's very doubtful that we can afford prosperity. Obviously, we have to lower our standard of living. That would secure the future of America. The only thing, but that it must be mentioned, because you do not live in history, you live as so poorly as Heracles said of the men who only works, you see, the journeymen, day by day. Your whole perspective horizon is just today. Can I buy a television set on the installment plan? That's the only question an American family is allowed to ask today in politics. Is that a question for decent people? Is that of any interest? That they should sit at home and labor the question whether they can afford a television set? This is to nobody's concern. Whether they buy it or not, it has nothing to do with history, politics, justice, law, anything. It's indifferent. It's of no importance. But it's built up today as being the important thing the President of the United States has to solve. If he doesn't solve it, he's not a good president. How can you have a good president? And that's what strikes everybody outside the United States, that we are only saved by the grace of God because sometimes Mr. Nero and sometimes Mr. Attlee and sometimes Mr. Churchill and sometimes Mr. Vito makes a clever remark or sometimes Mr. Adenauer, and we come to our senses again and know that we don't live in a world of fools. But at home, it's all just foolishness. Everything. I haven't seen, you see, this McCarthy business. 20 years ago, everybody here was a communist, and for 20 years you let the people run rampant. Now, the stable is empty, there are no communists in the United States, so we have a tremendous legislation against communists. Isn't that just funny? So the horse is stolen, now we lock the barn door. You never have horses again, be sure. There will be no political life in the United States because we now lock the barn so carefully that there can be no political movement. We will sit on any movement you see and say it's communism. This is all just fake. Can anybody take all any of these things seriously who has looked into the depths of God's creation, that God has created man so that he must die in his own generation and must his life must be continued by the second and third and fourth and fifth generation, and history only begins to be interesting if neither what you do nor what I do is important, but if we bear, unless we bear fruit, you see, we are not important. This I have tried to tell you in this class, gentlemen. And it is very difficult for me even to tell you because it's a question that is not raised. That this mystery of humanity, the mystery of sociology, the history, mystery of history is never to be found by looking at a mass here, a mob of 9,000 people and taking votes or questionnaires. The question is, what happens between two elections? I'm not interested in whether you elect Mr. Truman in 1 year, Mr. Eisenhower again. It has nothing to do with history. The problem is, if you want to understand history, is why in 1 year the people elect Truman and in the other term they elect Eisenhower, you see. It's in this span between the two elections that history begins to become interesting. That two different generations, although they do the opposite, still collaborate. Isn't that obvious? How can any one election be interesting? Not at all. But succession, gentlemen, and succession, that's the mystery of history. In what are we succeeded? Well, what's it? Does it matter now that Mr. Eisenhower a year ago said he was a crusader? Everybody's down on him for this, rightly now, because the two-thirds of his legislation is just the New Deal. Can a man who crusades in Europe then come home under the head of the victorious army to the people who have made him a supreme commander and says he's going to crusade at home against them? It's scandalous, but he doesn't know English. I mean, you cannot crusade at home when you have deserved the highest honors in your own country as commander-in-chief. Do you think that the Democrat soldiers can tolerate a general who is crusading against them? That all this can be, you can get away here with anything because that he when he spoke of a crusade a year ago, you see, people thought he had forgotten his own book titled Crusade in Europe. So he made it a civil war, the election. A war. Here you go out against the enemy of humanity, Mr. Hitler, and then you come home and say, now I'm going to do the same at home. This is letter he said. But it doesn't matter in this country, because nothing is held against him in what he said yesterday. You only hear what he says today. So you never understand what he says. Because, gentlemen, what we say makes only sense within the context of what was said yesterday, what will be said tomorrow. This gives light, sheds light on what we are saying today. Otherwise, you wouldn't understand what it means. It is only in the light of that which has been said before, and that will be said afterwards, that you even can understand what the phrase means. It is simply true, gentlemen, that as mere products of the football campus of America, you have no power to understand history. And that's why I have been driven year after year back to this problem that I have to give you an introduction into where the historical eye is located. No individual, gentleman, can look into history. I can only talk to you about history because I feel burned or molded or made into the carrier of this between generation view. This I've learned in a long life, to look between the generations. To give you a very pertinent example, gentlemen, why these eyes today destroy you, you see, as soon as you look at the life of Jesus and then look at Paul and Peter, you also destroy the history of Christianity into a natural history. Here lives one man, Mr. Jesus, and then lives Mr. Paul and Peter, and then you get for the last 150 years the famous story that Paul ruined Christianity. Now, Jesus, however, and the apostles formed together the apostolic church from the very day. All Christians agree on this, that what one generation of Christians, Jesus, taught the apostles, they applied. The greatness of Jesus was that he said, goodbye, you do it now in my place, when he was 33. And allowed the apostles to live a second generation and to prove that they had inherited the Holy Spirit. He could have lived on for 30 more years. Do you think he had to go to the cross? He didn't have to at all. But he had to make way for the freedom of life on this earth. And this he did. That's his only sacrifice. Everybody has to die. Don't make so much fuss about the crucifixion. Other people have been martyred. Why is it an extraordinary event? Because he could have done better what he left the 12 apostles to perform, so that people might learn that everybody, even the fishermen, even the most stolid men, had the same powers of the lowest of the low, had the same spirit as the genius, the son of God. And this is the greatest sacrifice a man can make, when he can lower himself, you see, below parity and say, I am not needed. If you love me, you have the same powers. So when the fact of Christianity is exactly the fact of Henry James and William James. It's exactly the same thing. You see, the problem, how a father, an older generation, Jesus, can
forced gradually Peter and Paul to the Orthodox Jew and the simple tribesmen, the fishermen, you see, to act as the greatest genius in his place. You know that Peter in the last minutes they wanted to leave Rome. And the Lord, he fired on the way from Rome to Naples, Peter, you see, runs into him, and what does the Lord say?
Go back.
No, he never says such a stupid thing.
No, well.
Quo vadis? Peter asked the Lord, Quo vadis? Where do you go? Yeah, he asked his master. And Jesus says, to be crucified a second time in Rome. Whereupon Peter understands and goes, rushes back to Rome and is crucified in Jesus' place. And head down he
is. He's done twice as great a cruelty as his master.
That's the story of Quo vadis. I never heard of Quo vadis.
But you never understood it.
It's the story of the two generations, sir, gentlemen. What I've tried to tell you is simply the famous course given by Mr. Bartlett in this college. I've told you about it on universal history. Haven't we talked about it? But in such terms that you can understand it as a problem between your father and yourself. It's the eternal problem of humanity. That is only what Christianity has done. Put the clock so right that you can see that is always the story. It is the eternal story. Christianity is only the first time that the story was consciously lived between two generations. That is Christianity. And that is the beginning of our era, you see. It is the beginning of men getting hold of his proper situation. That's all what Christianity is. The Christian era is a very practical thing. From that time on, more and more people, first only the apostles, and then the congregations, and then the bishops, and then the monks, and then the saints, and then the popes, and then the cities, and then the princes, and then the Puritans, and then this, as you see, learn how to live in historical relation to each other. And have to be studied. And now, it's getting worldwide. Gentlemen, the whole problem between Russia and America is the problem of the accumulation of capital. The whole problem of the reproduction of capital is the problem of fathers and sons. Shall a father withhold his capital income in a real invest for his sons in his big, I don't know, with his big factory system of the air, shall he go and spend it? You know this is the problem of the capital excess tax. The problem of the real, the Marxians call it the reproduction problem. That's exactly the problem of history of the apostolic church now carried into the production of goods. Shall one half of what we do, you see, be reserved to make other people, you see, produce? That's reproduction of capital, you see. Or shall we simply produce what we need and eat it? That's the whole problem of the capitalistic problems. It's a Christian problem. Never has before economy been baptized. The idea of which the world faces in the economic crisis of 1929 and in the Russian Revolution is the problem, can economics even be treated as Jesus treated the apostles? You don't believe this, gentlemen, but that's not blasphemy, that's my firm conviction. I've written a whole book, the autobiography of Western men on this topic. That the Russian Revolution and the World Wars are the last step of even bringing our relation to coal and oil and electricity and atomic energy into this same relation of inheritance, which has to be increased and cannot be simply eaten up, you see. The problem is investment, reinvestment, reproduction of capital, but accumulation of capital goods, whatever you call it, you see. And you know that's the key of the great five-year plan in Russia. This relation, again, Henry James and his son, the same thing. How much freedom must I give my son in his own generation to discover the truth? How much must I impose on him, you see? Do you remember what I said about genius and authority? Now, the whole problem of the five-year plan is genius and authority, again. The genius today could produce enough to give all the Russians all the eggs and the butter they need. But then there would be nothing provided for the next generation. The next generation would not have, as William James said, this endowment of having its own capital goods.
Yeah? Sir, it's the historical example of this relation between father and son or generations is found in Christ and his relation to the apostles Peter and Paul. You told us when we were studying the Jameses that the essential thing that has to be passed on is the genius of the father to the son, not so much the authority. Well, in this historical example of Christ and the apostles, what happened to the authority? Was it passed on or was it not?
Paul never quotes Christ as well. He's completely free. No words have been. The Spirit is in him. We have, so as the Act says, we have given over our souls to his Spirit. That is, he has nothing in him. But Paul declares, explains, interprets, commands, organizes in his own way, in his own way, in the name. But
not
never saying that Christ has said so. Never. That's not what we call our thought.
Well, I think we definitely have authority, because it occurs to me that he is using his authority, speaking in his name, and only because Christ lives and has his authority.
But in him, sure.
Yeah, and this...
But speaks directly, that he is fresh from David. The new creation. It's not quotation. It's not law. The authority is by right. I mean, they are the same law, you see, which is not the same as living water. I mean, as long as the apostles fulfill the requirement of sacrificing their own will to this authority, they are allowed to speak in the law. But quite rightly, there is more to it than genius and authority in this world. Because the abdication of these apostles is of their own will. They are, of course, required. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What time, please? Would you be able, Grandma, to finish your paper?
Yes, sir.
How long is it?
23 pages.
Who has to leave at 2:45? Well, then we can't go on. Although, you will be then the first next time. We come back now to Cooper. In his case, gentlemen, we can study an aspect of the James problem, which again is unknown here. He discovers aristocracy, or he still keeps aristocracy. And as you remember in this paper, it was said that he is an aristocrat, and he revels in Paris in the salons with the duchess and the counts and the nobility and the aristocracy of the spirit mind. And here he is all for the natural Red Indian, you see. So he has this cleavage in his mind that he is semi-democrat and semi-aristocrat, as most Americans are. I mean, I have still to find a democratic American. There's nobody who is taken in by royalty and by title as the mentioned. This is on his campus. If I tell you the stories of hoaxes, which have been worked on the Dartmouth community over the last 15 years, you would laugh. One pseudo after another pseudo title has imposed on people. We were unfortunately being a little bit sophisticated, able to look through these hoaxes, but remember one?
Lady Montague.
Yes,
sure.
Lady Montague. It just happened a year ago. Well, she called herself Lady Montague. She was a domestic servant from St. Louis, somewhere. And she ended in jail. But before, everybody in this college obediently had invited her to their homes and feel greatly honored. Because she called herself Lady, which only goes to prove that it is still
It's effective to call yourself Lady Montague.
Well, I can give you a number of other examples, but it doesn't matter. Only I haven't yet to find a democratic American. You all want to descend from some royalty in Europe, and everybody you know can have his pedigree fabricated here in some nice manner. And there's always somebody whom you will not admit to your fraternity or to your club, and that makes you feel good. You need always somebody who cannot make it, because otherwise it would be no fun to make it. And this discrepancy is only normal. I have nothing against it. The only funny thing is that you decline to accept it. That you would say this isn't, and that you even sell democracy to other peoples when they come to see in this country that it doesn't exist. I mean, the Europeans, of course, laugh their heads off when the Americans talk about democracy. I assure you, Europeans in many ways are much more democratic. If I am a professor at Dartmouth, it is decided in here in the ranks of the Scholastic Society that I can be no good, because here are no people of any who amount to anything in Dartmouth. They are only football players. If this isn't true in Europe, if you belong to any high school, the people will still admit that you can be good, even if you belong to Dartmouth. But here it's absolutely exclusive. A man at Harvard just doesn't talk to a man at Dartmouth.
I mean, in the faculty, it's just no problem.
Only to show you that we all live by these discrepancies and these discriminations, and no discrimination. Life begins by discrimination. That doesn't mean, gentlemen, that we shouldn't fight for the other. And only the things are much more complicated. This is much richer. Life is much richer than you want to know. The funny thing about man is that he has to have several tenets and to strive equally strong for example, we need a powerful central government and we need decentralization. That's not a contradiction. You see? We need both. We need decentralization and centralization. People will say, well, you either have to be a centralist or a decentralist. I don't see it at all. I'm a conservative, I'm progressive. But I cannot be all the time, in every point a progressive, and cannot be all the time a conservative, you see. But man begins, obviously, when he's both. The man who says, I'm always progressive, tires me. And man who says, he's always a reactionary, is equally unimportant. The people who are interesting are the people who at times are one thing and at times are the other. It's contradictory, sure. But it's very contradictory to inhale and to exhale. And yet life begins by this very fact. You eat and you shit. Now, you cannot say I just go on eating. And you cannot say I just go on shitting. You have to alternate. What's wrong about this? You cannot have founded on any one of these principles. But you don't want to hear this, because you don't want to be in history. I mean, I've tried to show you that Henry James and William James are like inhaling and exhaling. You remember what we tried to say? That you cannot understand the one without the trust and the love of the other. That his father at his breakfast table pouring out his Christian truth, obviously, you see, wanted to bring down some seed into the ground. And I had to leave it to his faith and to weather and wind and to the years to come what his son would make of it. You see. That was his business. But his son, on the other hand, received from his father the whole eloquence, all the topics of conversation, although he was quite free to twist them around and to omit some things. But here, the eloquence, we said, comes to the sons from the father. Remember? So there is a tie-up. You cannot look the life of Henry James into Henry James. And you cannot look the principle of democracy into people who allegedly always live democratic. You find it just as much in people who try to live aristocratic. Now, this he does, and that's where you have the premise of Cooper, that there are I have a quarter of an hour, and I want to give you a really important. From his parents, that when William James gives up Henry James Christianity and says, I'm a scientist, I know nothing but what my senses tell me. I have not this historical view of one big stream of a Holy Spirit going. Well, what William James' position is, and yours is a psychologist's position, you see, confining himself to looking at this man and what he goes on in his mind, that's psychologizing, that's psychology, you see. Psychology is the application of the principle of nature to men's spirit and soul. And so he says, I see that this boy wetted his bed at 2, therefore his soul is wet all the rest of his life. And that you call nowadays psychoanalysis. Which means that you look for the importance of the man's actions in that which is confined between his cradle and his death. Whereas obviously the New Deal has absolutely nothing to do with Mr. Roosevelt's infantile paralysis or his digestion, but it has to do with the development of industry in 5 generations. That he finally had to say that labor is not a commodity has nothing to do with his psychoanalysis that he was under the thumb of his mother. And any psychologizing about Mr. Roosevelt's New Deal is ridiculous. Utterly ridiculous. But that's what people say to tell you today. That you can find in his antecedents as a body, as a boy in the cradle, the explanation of his acts. Fairly fantastic. Every word he says is outside his own body. It has a meaning in the history of thousands of years when a man says new and he says deal. He uses words that are 5,000 years old. And therefore it has absolutely doesn't come out of him. It goes through him. He's just a carrier. It is, but this is what people tell you today. They say that the electric light is to be explained by the isolation around the cable between 2 masts. Is this true? You see? The mass being everybody's physique, you see, and the electric light has very little to do with the wood of the poles. But that's what you are told all the time by psychologists, that the wood of the mass pole determines whether there shall be electricity in the cables or not. What I do in the society, gentlemen, of men, for peace or for war, or that has absolutely nothing to do with whether I'm a cripple or whether I'm 6 feet 6 foot 6. But you don't believe it. That's all that you call this today's great secrets of psychology. They didn't even touch religion. I mean, Mr. Ramling made a speech. Did you, who listened to him? Did you go to his lecture? The symposium of the psychology program. He didn't even see that this had nothing to do with each other. The malformations of the psychologists and what in the history of mankind is considered a sin. The idolatry of the golden calf, that's a sin, but it has nothing to do with the malformation of the children, the individual children of Israel, you see. Not the slightest. They could have a good digestion or poor digestion, they could be wet their net, or they could, you see, love their sister, or it has absolutely nothing to do with worshiping the golden calf. But this is what today people tell you, that your digestion or your desire to have to go to bed with somebody will be an act legislation. The Bible is very careful to warn you against it. As you know, in the pedigree of Jesus, there are very questionable ladies. Because the Bible wants to make sure that the great decisions of mankind have absolutely nothing to do with the morality of the people who do it. If you are sensitive to this current of history, of the electric current, you see, you can be a cripple, you can be a criminal, you can be stupid, and you can be a genius. If you have this senses, this sixth sense of history, you are fit for the kingdom of heaven. And you don't have it, you can pass all the examinations with A. And you can absolutely stultify yourself to the decisions that have to be made. Hoover was certainly an A student, but he just couldn't stop the Depression. He had no sense, no political sense. He's an engineer. Engineers just don't have that sense. I mean, I'm aware of the technician gentleman in politics. He's a man who doesn't understand. Never. Anything. President Cohen is such a man. So they made him High Commissioner in Germany. Doesn't understand a thing of politics. He's a chemist. And when he was made president, the old Professor Whitehead, the great philosopher, the British, heard this and said, "Boy, it's impossible, you can't do this, you can't make a president of the greatest university can be a chemist." Well, he said, "Why not? President Eliot of Harvard was a chemist too." Oh, he said, "But that's very different. Eliot was a poor chemist, but Conant is a good chemist." Only to show you that to conduct history, the affairs of men, is a thing by itself which cannot be reduced to any endowment, you see, with a good physique or a good brain or any of that thing, because it's a relation to the things before you and after you, and not to the things you can touch and weigh and see and mix and boil up in a chemical compound. What can these physicists do? Produce atom bombs. That's their contribution to history. That is, any natural scientist who enters history destroys. That's all he can do. The letter of Mr. Einstein to President Roosevelt that he should build the atom bomb, that will be the immortality in history of Mr. Einstein, and not that he had a good brain in mathematics and physics. It's very interesting. And that's his only contribution. But they all pose these people as peace Nobel Prize winners. But the physicist's contribution to the world of man is destruction. Power. Mechanics. And it takes a long time of ministers and teachers and mothers and monks and nuns and deacons and nurses to heal any one of the wounds that one of these big physicists can produce in the body of mankind. But in this country, all the values stand on their head. So Mr. Einstein is the great genius of peace. He has a window in Riverside Church. Just brain power. It has nothing to do with what men is craving as a continuity of the human race on this earth. Now, Cooper's and Henry William James Jr. and any or Mr. Einstein, in developing any one in their own time secular invention of them, always to a certain extent belong to the pre-Christian order. That is, gentlemen, if you for one moment allow me to be you take Greek science, you take the Christianity, that's the beginning of our era, that's plus minus zero, and you get the year 1865, William James or Cooper 1821. Mr. William James decides, I'm a scientist. That he is, let us allow me to say this, he goes Greek. He says this, he becomes an academic. Academic is just another expression for allowing a mind
to concentrate on that was the great stone in pre-Christian days. The word academic is the word for the renaissance of the Greek mind. Now, since the Greek mind is polytheistic, worships many things, the arts and the boys and the girls, they love both, as you know, and the muses and the graces and Bacchus and Venus and everything. They are polytheistic, and in this sense, any Greek departmentalization of the mind, the famous ivory tower, is always pre-Christian by establishment. A man who just goes zoologic, in for zoology, as William James did in 1865 when he went to Brazil, says, I'm not responsible at this moment for making peace between men of goodwill, but I am going out because I'm interested in government. Now that's all right. There is in every one moment.